Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Secrets in the City podcast, where we turn shameful secrets into life-changing lessons so people like you and me can cut the weight of the past and move forward with remarkable confidence. My name is Dr. Catherine Isco, and I'll be your proud host for this new podcast series. Welcome.
Hi, guys. A gentle heads up. While this podcast provides an open space for the exchange of ideas and a supportive platform for growth, it's important to recognize that some of the content might be just a little bit emotionally triggering.
So I just want to start this episode by saying we've actually been talking for the past 5 minutes and I forgot to press record. Isn't that funny how things first times, as Brené Brown says, effing first times. And I have to say that you can only go uphill from here, can you not? So welcome new listeners to the Secrets in the City podcast, where we turn shameful secrets into lifelong lessons. My guest today, what you guys have missed in the past 5 minutes, because I forgot to press record, is that we've opened up a bottle of champagne and a bottle of whiskey. And my guest has poured himself what looks to be more of a mug full rather than a nice shot full of whiskey. But we'll get to that in a second. Now, how to describe my next guest? He is, I believe, a walking paradox. He is very, very driven. I mean, like a bull to red. Yet he is able to find incredible balance in his life. He is also extremely hard-headed, like I am as well. Yet, I think over the years, we have both learned how to become more open-minded to seeing the other sides of the coin. And lastly, he is highly opinionated, especially when he has a whiskey in his hand, which he does now. But he's also able to be extremely loving. He is a walking paradox, but he is my walking paradox. He is my cheerleader. He's the love of my life. He's also sometimes my stylist. He's also sometimes my therapist and psychologist. He is my sounding board. He is what I call an angel because he came to me quite a bit later on in life. And I truly believe that angels do exist and he is my angel. So welcome to my beautiful partner, Vlado Bosanac.
Now that was quite a introduction. Where do I go from there? Might have to have a couple more sips of my whiskey.
There you go. Are you going to tear up?
Not yet.
Not yet, but hey, there's always time.
There's always time.
I'd like to start by asking you your version of how we met. And I say your version because after Vlado says his version, I'm going to actually tell everyone the true version of how we met.
Well, your version versus my version of how I met, or we met. So, yeah, no, we met through a mutual friend who had the hots for you. And we were out at dinner one night and he knew you were nearby, so he invited you to join us. And whilst he was texting on his phone for 5 hours, we were chatting for 5 hours in amongst having a nice meal and you stealing things from my plate.
Yes, you're a bit anal retentive about that.
Yeah, I couldn't believe it was happening, but I was polite on that particular occasion.
The one and only occasion.
That's a hard one.
So let me tell you the true story of this. There is some truth into what he said. Actually, everything is really true, but I want to paint a bigger and perhaps more clear picture of how we met. I was doing my doctorate, and again, like Vlado said, we had a mutual friend, obviously not at that time, and he invited me to Rockpool. I didn't really know what Rockpool was, so I arrived in my student hill-beaten car that was worth all of $2,000, and I couldn't find a parking spot, so Vlado kindly suggested that he pay for my valet because I was getting very frustrated finding a parking spot. So, of course, I arrived, and you need to picture that there was Maseratis, Lamborghinis, you know, Mercedes, everything under the sun. And then I pull up in this war-torn car and not embarrassed, but perhaps more mortified. And I turn over and look and see my friend and also Vlado standing next to him. Now, Vlado is a very unique individual in the sense that he doesn't blend in. He has a bald head, but a very beautiful bald head in my view. He's wearing an Ed Hardy bedazzled shirt, V-neck, no doubt. The t-shirt was tucked in with a very, very suave belt. And I can't remember the kind of jeans you had, but let me just say that they definitely stood out with very rocking, pointy shoes. So I just want to say that my first impression was, who the F is this wanker? That was my initial impression. Now, the reason why I'm saying that is because a lot of my, you know, clients and students and so forth are single, and they often think, okay, he's never going to be for me. The rest of the story, the long and short of it, is that we got along like a house on fire. We simply clicked. And from that point onwards, he chased me. Because I was in my, I hate men, I don't need a man stage, everything is blah. And he never let up on me. It took about a year for me to say yes to a date. And all throughout that time, he said, one day you're going to tell me that you love me. And I thought he was smoking something fierce. And I think we're 8.5 years into our relationship. And I have to admit, you were right. I love you more than I can ever even express.
It's good to know.
Is that a good version of the story?
Yeah, no. Well, that you could have flavored it a bit more. So I'm going to let you run with that version because it's accurate. You missed out some bits that I probably wouldn't have liked, but no, that works for me. But, you know, going back to the outfit on the particular evening, I looked good. I was buff. I was sporting 20-inch arms, veins, pecs. That, you know, it was going on, and it worked at the time.
But you know what really hit home for me was your confidence.
No. Me?
Yeah.
Okay.
I know. Weird, eh?
Weird.
Oh, who would have thunk that?
Mm-hmm.
So we've been dating for 8+ years, and one of the things that is a bit of a sticking point, I mean, there's been several sticking points along the way, but one of them was, if we got married, that you want me to take your last name.
Yeah.
And this is really big, whereas I don't want to change my name because, as you know, I have my father is my be-all and end-all, and I think I want to keep his name and pass on his name. I mean, not that we're going to have kids, but pass on in the sense of keep it. So where is this whole thing about taking name? Where does that come from?
I think it's probably just some of my old school way of doing things. You know, it's probably embedded in my head that if you're proud enough to marry me, I'd like to have the pride of you carrying my name. So I believe we got to hyphenation or something of that nature, which
compromise.
I'm cool with too, because, you know, your daddy is a seller guy. So at the end of the day, I understand the linkage and why you need it so badly. But flipping the coin on the other side, I want to be as proud of as that of you carrying my name.
Fair enough. Hence why we came to a handshake compromise, I believe, over something like this, whiskey and champagne.
Yeah,
we haven't put that in writing yet. So it's been an interesting ride in regards to our relationship and compromise, which I think many others can relate to. But a big compromise, or perhaps a big bump in the road that we both went through, was about 3 years into our relationship, where you wanted to call it off. And I have to say, this was not from absolute left field, because I think we were disagreeing on a few points by that point. But take us back to when you basically, for lack of a better word, you wanted to dump me.
You know, I can't even remember what it was about, in all honesty. I just think it was one of those times where we clashed. And it was probably something stupid, but just ignorance. And I'm hand on heart, I think I've grown a lot since then. But coming out of, you know, multiple different relationships over my life, it was always easier to walk away than deal with so much compromise all the time. So if there's something you've certainly taught me, which I say you teach a lot of people in all honesty, and I think even when you're teaching other people these things, I pick up from what I see happening and try to be better. And I think that's probably the one thing in our relationship that's empowered us, is that I can honestly say today, I love you more today than I did when I first told you I love you. So it hasn't diminished. It's got stronger, more proud of you, And yeah, it's just, I can't remember why we fought, but I think it was just we were clashing consistently at the time over just dumb shit. And yeah, but you know, kudos to you. You pulled me up and you made me talk it through. Mm-hmm. And in a very short amount of time on the couch, without even leaving the couch, it was resolved. And I pretty much remember apologizing for being so ignorant.
I think the big thing is, I think you and I can both see the end game. And that I believe is quite challenging in a relationship, because it's so easy to get stuck in the now that you don't really see or take the time to understand the effort that's put in now goes to an end game. And I think this is something that you and I both do in our lives. But I think this has been learned over many, many, many years.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think when I look at the end game now too, there's no part of the end game that doesn't include you. So, you know, we're working towards something together, albeit that we work in two very different channels, if you like, in the business. But as a couple, and I don't want to be embellishing it or anything, but I think as a couple, I would look at us as a couple and be something that I'd want to aspire to, because we talk about everything. You know, we look at everything. You know, I can have a crappy day and you can have a fantastic day, and you won't talk about your fantastic day until we've got past my crappy day. You know, so, and I think vice versa with that. We engage on a level, and I want to be careful how I say some of this, because I don't want this to sound construed, because this is something people who are going to want to meet you and talk to you and engage and understand what I've gone through will come to recognize when they do meet you. And it's amazing.
One of the things I think that was a massive blocker for me was because I am who I am, very open, and perhaps I have an addiction to hugging people and really getting close to people. And because of your past, you saw that in a different way, and there was high levels of jealousy, and this is something that we've spoken about before. How do you think that you got over that jealousy? And perhaps maybe taking it one step back is, where did that jealousy come from?
Well, jealousy is insecurity at the end of the day. It's you looking at yourself feeling you have shortfalls more so than the other person. And it probably came from a number of things. It was infidelity in previous relationships. It was not considering the other person as well as you can, and not understanding the relationship and the bond, because you're so transient in relationships. And I think that's something that happens these days. People are, for want of a better word, transient in relationships. They take them on a day-by-day basis rather than involve their future in a relationship. And that's why you hear about things like the 7-year itch and all of these things. We're at 8 years plus, so we're good.
But
no, I just think that yeah, it just comes from not navigating relationships well for most of my life, you know. And I've been married a couple of times, as you know, and to some great girls. They were great ladies. And my ex-wife, the mother of my children, and I are better friends now than we were when we were married. And I think it's great for our kids. I think it's certainly great for us, because there's nothing you want to do that involves arguing all the time with people. So, yeah, I think it's all of those things.
So getting back to the marriage thing, you've been married 3 times, I'll be your 4th. Has this been ever perhaps judged or looked upon unfavorably by others that you can remember?
Probably everybody would look at it unfavorably, but I'm sort of a big unit, so not a lot of people would say anything to me about that.
Why do you think that they would look upon it unfavorably?
Well, I think, you know, one of the things you wanted to talk about today was, what would I see as my greatest failure in my life? And it's probably never sticking it out in something that I just thought, ugh, this is just too hard. And relationships is one of those things, you know. So yeah, it's just having the tenacity, if you like, to challenge things in a more open way.
Okay, hold on. So on one hand, you're saying that perhaps it's a judgment on giving up on something that perhaps is meaningful. So is that you are, I guess, frustrated with yourself that you gave up, or are you worried that other people are going to know that you gave up on something, if that makes sense?
It's probably a combination of things because, you know, I'm like you. I think I want to know how my family feels about things as much as, you know, your friends are your friends. And, you know, I have a lot of acquaintances. You know, I've met thousands of people in my life that I could touch base with, thousands of them. That's the beauty of my Rolodex. I could touch base with somebody in nearly every country in the world. But friends, I can probably count them on two hands. Mm. So the people that matter to you, that if you did something or you're on the front page of the paper or, you know, for the wrong reasons or anything like that, you'd feel bad about it. So it's really that reflection back into what my family thinks maybe when they think, shit, he's going to do it again kind of thing. You know, I remember my brother said to me on my third marriage, I think we're going to buy a suit because by the time I keep hiring them, I may as well have bought one. So, well, yeah, it's a bit like that, isn't it?
Did he actually buy the suit?
No.
Okay.
He hired one.
Okay. Because for our wedding, I'm not sure about suits. Mm. We're going to be on a boat.
Yeah, I'm seeing deck shoes and linen pants.
Although my dress is going to be, like, kick-ass.
Has to be.
Totally. I'm thinking I'm going to go for two dresses. Because there needs to be a dress for the ceremony, but then there needs to be another dress that I can do the robot in on the dance floor. So I really have to think strategically on this one because one is Zazazu and the other one is comfort and movement. Because even like doing staying alive, like when you're really reaching up those arms and I leave nothing to chance on the dance floor, as you know.
Yeah, nothing.
Nothing. And so that's the other thing is we are very different. We are chalk and cheese in so many ways. I mean, you're Croatian, I'm Canadian. You want to buy the world, I want to save it. You say F, I say sorry. Like, do you ever think that you'd end up with someone like me?
Hot? Absolutely.
Okay, that's such a boy thing to say.
Yeah.
Boobs and butt.
You know, how do I answer that? Did I think I'd end up with someone like you? Everybody's so different and everyone's got their own qualities. So I couldn't say yes or no to that. I've always been very shallow, like most guys are, in regards to, you know, boobs, butt and looks. And fortunately, I've got the gift of the gab, so I've always had boobs, button looks around me. Always, you know, people say you're punching way above your weight class, but it's not really. It's that I know how to navigate the realm of getting what I want, hence I'm with you. But
the best deal you've ever won.
Yeah, it is. It's the best deal I ever closed, and probably because you made it so tough for me, it's probably one of the best deals I ever respected that I closed as well. So, yeah, it's I don't know how to answer that. I'm jumping around. I don't know how to answer, did I think I'd end up with someone like you? I always thought I'd end up with someone I was be happy with, and it's you. So, yeah.
See, for me, perhaps because I was looking for relationships as external validation for my very low self-esteem, and perhaps this is a very North American thing, you think you're going to date the quarterback who is doing a concurrent law degree at Harvard, he's Jewish, he's got a good family, you know, it's like the ticka, 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 ticka. And I think a lot of women, or at least I know I was on that, where I needed to have the ticks on the list to essentially say, if you don't have all of these things, then you are not for me. Yet, the funny thing is that so many women that I know are okay with accepting less than what they deserve. And this is obviously a generalization, but I see this mostly, perhaps maybe it's because of my age here in Australia, is that women are perhaps not treated the way that I think that they deserve here.
Do you think that's an Australian thing, though? Or I think I see that everywhere, and I travel a lot, as you know.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I think that that ticking in the box thing is that ideal situation that people look at. But then what they sometimes don't look at is when they've got the good-looking guy, the quarterback, the law degree, and all of those things, the amount of insecurity it then causes them to have, because they look at that and then they're then worrying about where he is tonight with his mates, what's he doing, you know, he's coming home late, and, you know, there's all that peripheral stuff as well. And if you don't build it on the right foundations, does it work out when it was all about, you know, looks, boobs and butt? Not necessarily. And, you know, it's certainly not worked for me every time. And yeah, it's you've got to look at it and think, well, and that's why we work, right? Because the things that you really wanted in someone, I think, are the things I personify, which are confidence, driven. You've never seen me say that's happening and it hasn't. And I support you 100%. You know, my day finishes looking at you. My morning starts looking at you. I walk into your office 50 times a day and I give you a kiss.
Well, and you grab my boobs.
Well, I was going to say that, but okay, yes.
You do. So, I just want to say to all the audience.
It's quid pro quo, you know, something's got to be in it for me as well. But, yeah, no, it's finding that balance in somebody that, and respect should come anyway, but it's somebody that, I'm going to nearly call it idolizes, you know, like looks at what you're doing each day and what you're achieving and how hard you try and appreciates that as well, because then you're getting the gratification of and that stimulation from the relationship as well. Because I'm a high achiever and I always have been all my life. You know, I remember laying in bed at 16 years of age and thinking I'm never going on social security payments, and I was surrounded with guys from the school I went to that went onto the dole pretty much straight out of school, and I refused to do that, and I left school into a job. I've always had a job. I worked for myself my entire life. You know, I had goals that I hit and missed through life, but it maybe hit them late. But I think it's all those things, you know. You really want to have someone in your life that runs alongside you, not in your shadow.
And on that, one of the secret that you picked, so for the new listeners, obviously you're new because this is the first episode, hey, but the premise around this show is that I get my guests to pick a secret, or now to preface this by saying that I have thousands of secrets, and the secret that you selected was this, and I'll just read it out here. Is I'm scared that I'll remain single for the rest of my life and never be loved. Why do you think you picked that? Why do you think you picked that secret?
Well, the book that I got to choose from was pretty deep. And I think it resonated too, because I think even when we look at our friendship circle with some of our friends that have single with someone, single with someone, single with someone, and they stay with that someone because they fear being alone instead of empowering themselves to make better decisions in who they should be with. And you know, I look at my mum, who, you know, left my father when I was 9. He was very violent, and she just had to get out of the relationship. And she brought us here to Perth, and, you know, she remarried once, and it didn't work out. And she's never gone into another relationship again. So she doesn't fear being alone. I'm sure she has moments of loneliness, but there's a difference between I'm feeling lonely and you cuddle your cat versus I'm lonely and I'm alone.
Absolutely. You know? One of the things, one of my favorite researchers, Brené Brown, talks about, there's a big difference between feeling alone, or sorry, I should say being alone, and being lonely. Being alone, especially for an introvert, is rejuvenating. We need it to recharge and enable us to be able to go out in a very social world. Loneliness is that feeling of no one loves me. And I think there's a big difference between the two.
100%. And we see that, like I was saying earlier on, in friends, that that they fear being alone. But I think, and I'm not mentioning names because I don't think that's the right thing to do, but you can see they're not actually lonely. Do you know what I mean? Even when they're on their own, they're so active. They've got so much on and they're engaging with so many people. But it's just the fear of being alone that I think is what eats at them, not so much that they're lonely.
Do you think it's somewhat of a self-fulfilling prophecy? And I'll need to explain this. What I'm thinking is when I was, 28, 29, I was living in Toronto. This is, those years that you think you want to become, partner with someone and so forth. The more alone I was, the lonelier I felt, and therefore the less I wanted to go out and meet someone. Or when I did go out, I would be so desperate to meet someone that I would just latch on to the first person that gave me attention. And this would sort of fuel that negative cycle. So you're damned if you do and damned if you don't. So what is a person meant to do? How do you think a person can effectively and efficiently build inner confidence to enable them to be able to go out and have a secure and healthy partnership?
I think I'm the wrong person to ask that question because I've always approached these things with such confidence. But I think you're right. I think that what happens is the people have such a period of alone time that when they do get attention from someone, they lean into it too hard. And if the other person isn't feeling it straight away, it can be quite repelling where they go, whoa, that's heavy duty. They're trying too hard or they're clingy. And it creates the wrong vibe in the early part of the relationship where you feel that person's too needy or they're clinging to you. So, but that again is out of being alone, finally having someone giving you that attention. So you grasp for it constantly. You want that attention. And I don't think human nature is different on anyone. We always want that validation that someone else thinks you're fantastic, you're pretty, or so on. And that's why, the one thing I think is probably elevated in our relationship is, and I say it to you, I tell you beautiful all the time. So when someone else does, I think that works better because you want to know that internally that it's not just the person you hear it from all the time. And I think that's that, and there's nothing evil or damaging about that, whereas in previous relationships, if another man was paying attention to my woman, I would be very aggressive about it. Mm. And I don't think that makes sense looking back on it now because that validation from other people is great. It should happen. And I shouldn't belittle it by being upset with you because of it. I think it doesn't say who you are. Do you know what I mean? It doesn't say who you're gonna be or what you're gonna do behind my back. That is not who you are. And I think that's the trust we've built in our relationship by there is no clinginess. Mm-hmm. There is constant growth in our relationship and it works. It just gels. It works well.
And I think we've had to build that trust, especially because, pre-pandemic, how many miles did you do in 1 year? Was it 150,000 miles or more? 300,000.
I did 387,000 miles on planes last year.
Yeah.
And this year, before the shutdown, I did 144,000 miles on planes. So we're away from each other most of the time.
Right. I would say that I said goodnight to you via FaceTime 10 times more than I did at home. And within that, I think one of the funniest things is there's a place in Singapore, and I won't obviously mention the name, but let's just say it's not so much for drinking, it's more for visual entertainment, and the audience can sort of take that for what it is. But one of the funny things is that you usually call me from there, typically after about 7 whiskeys, and say, you wouldn't believe what happened, you wouldn't believe what's going on. And I'm just like, yeah, whatever, and I'm going to sleep.
Yeah.
Because I trust you.
Yeah, and in all honesty, you have no reason not to. But and that's one of the funny things, that I will be with the guys in Singapore, and they all want to, all roads lead to Rome. Mm-hmm. And they'll say, oh, we're going to go here. Mm-hmm. And I go, great, let's go. And they'll go, what? And I'll call you on the way, and I'll say, hey, I'm just with the boys, we're going to such and such. Mm-hmm. And you'll say, cool, honey, have a great time,
Yeah, and give me the goss.
Yeah. And the other guys look at me like, holy shit, like you tell her you go there? So, yeah, well, why not? I'm not doing anything. I'm having a drink. It's in the hotel that I stay in. Mm. And you have no issue with it, And in all honesty, if you had issue with it, I wouldn't.
Yeah.
You go there, but it's great visual entertainment.
Yeah. And I think one of the things that we say is, you can go out for a hamburger, but the good steak is at home.
Yeah, it's the fillet.
There we go.
100%. Or what does Al Bundy say? He says, you can go out for milk, but there's a cow at home.
There you go. You know? Now, I guess the way you approach relationships, obviously I'm privy to this information, but I think a lot of it has been built on your childhood and specifically what you saw in your parents. Now, to preface this in saying that we actually had already recorded this episode, but because of the audio wasn't really good, that's why we're re-recording this one. But there are some things that you simply cannot re-record. And when I asked Vlado to share a secret that he had never shared with the world before, I'd like to play this pre-recorded audio. And Vlado, I'd like you to listen to it as I play it, and then we'll talk about it afterwards.
Ready, Freddy.
My father was a very Croatian, aggressive, old school male that took his hand to my mum on any occasion he saw fit. And amazingly, she put up with it for a very, very long time. And I think some of that, you know, is from the fact that she had children, wanted a roof over their head and the stability of that. But you know, there were many occasions when it would be the early hours of the morning, I would hear her screaming because he was basically beating her up for some reason. And, I remember one occasion, which I'm sure is the one you're reflecting on, the bedroom that I slept in was where my dad kept his guns. And I remember this particular night hearing my mother screaming, thinking, I could stop this. Because Dad taught us how to use guns. I was sitting in bed thinking, I'll just grab the gun and I'll kill him. If I kill him, you know, I'm not going to jail. I'm too young. The situation and what it was, you know, nothing would have really happened to me, but my mum would be free of him. You know, 46 years since I've seen my dad. I don't believe there's been a day I've missed him or thought I'd really like to see him again. It's just not an influence that I need in my life. And I think it's made me a better father, to be quite honest.
Hearing that replay, what's the first thing that comes to mind?
It was a tough time in life, you know. Mum went through a lot. We went through a lot. You know, it was inevitably not long after that Mum left Dad as well. And never saw him again after that and the rest of my life. And, mind you, never tried. So it certainly gave me some good moulding as to what I wanted to make sure I wasn't as a father. And that it was tough. It's one of those things that never leaves you. There are a few things that I remember from my childhood with my dad. None of them are good. None of them, yeah.
Do you ever speak with Tom, your brother, about it?
Not really. No, he's got his own anger. You know, he was a bit older than me, so he challenged my father, mm-hmm. Whereas I was younger and just scared, so I just didn't. Yeah, it was. He had a very different relationship. And when there was an opportunity to meet with my dad later in life, and that was being set up pretty much between my mum, his new wife, and half-sister, Tom was just flat out, no way, not interested. Mm-hmm. And I sort of gave it some thought and I just thought, nah, I don't want to do it. No, I just don't see the need. If you couldn't be my father for the 20 years of my life that I needed you to be, don't step up now that I'm a grown man doing my own thing. Yeah.
So on that note, do you think people deserve second chances?
Listen, I think they absolutely do. You know, there are things that I've done in my life that I would do differently. That particular one, that's the thorn in the side. That's the one that you just, it'd be so hard to, even now, you know, with where I am in life. And funnily enough, recently, Bernadette, my ex, reached out to me and said, is that your father on Facebook? And it was my half-sister celebrating his birthday and photos of him on Facebook, which I hadn't seen any photos of him for probably 10 years. Mm. And nothing gave me an urge to reach out. Yeah, there's just nothing there. But, you know, the positive side of who he was as a father has made me be a different father to my children.
So would you say that's how you've turned that sort of secret, if you will, into a lifelong lesson?
100%. Absolutely zero question, because I look at how violent he was and everything about him, and when I've seen those traits in me start to materialise in my younger years and things, I've really steered directly in the other direction. It just is not who I wanted to be. Yeah.
If your 7 or 8 year old self, which is what you were within that sort of secret that you just shared with us, if he were sitting in the seat that I'm sitting in, what would you say to him?
Something I've not spent a lot of time on, because I think even the conversations I've had with my half-sister, he continued to be that person, that violent, you know, aggressive, physical person, even with her when she was growing up. And it's unforgivable. You know, he's, and I could be completely wrong, but there's nothing about what I've ever heard, even after in life, that says to me he's changed in any way. And it was nearly like it was a generational acceptance that to, you know, take a hand to your partner was just normal.
The silent generation.
Yeah, to pull them into line, and, you know, and it's just not okay. But it's amazing, you know, that, and I've not answered your question. I don't know what I'd say to him. Disappointment. I think a lot of emotions would come out, you know, that just, and I think that just airing the disappointment in him and the violence that he showed to my mother and to my brother and I. He was a fantastic provider. We lived in a beautiful home. We had a very nice life. And maybe that's something I got from him. You know, he worked for himself. But I'd like to think I've kept the good and, you know, got rid of the bad.
Do you think that's the way he compensated for his, perhaps, the Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde
side of him? In all honesty, when I look at historically the way I've been in my relationships or in my past, and where the jealousy is really spawned from, it comes from your own infidelity, your own inconsistency, and your own lack of trust that you can be given, so you can't give it because you think all of those sleights of hand are exactly what you've been doing. So you look at it very differently. You know, the late nights, the early mornings, the, you know, late home from works, the, you know, everything, every lie you could tell that you've got to then remember that you do, which is just not good enough. That's where it comes from. That's where that insecurity comes from.
So it gives you a tainted view of the world.
100%. Yeah, it makes you look twice at everything rather than just go, well, that's just what it was, you know.
So in regards to something that you would say to your 7-year-old self, do you think perhaps it would just be, this isn't your fault, you don't have to fix it? Is that potentially one thing?
Yeah, I think so. I think you can't help it then, because I remember my mum getting hit by my dad because my brother and I might have been throwing a tennis ball and I got stuck in one of the gutters, and it then flooded the gutter and it went into the roof and there was damage he had to fix. When he found the ball up there, I remember her standing between him and us because he was going to hit us for it, and she copped it on our behalf. So, yeah, you sort of think some things you do blame yourself for and you can't help, but then some things are just so left of centre, 2 o'clock in the morning, violent arguments and things. And it was his insecurity and jealousy because of what I think he was doing in his life. He then thought anything she might have been, and she wasn't allowed to work, she wasn't allowed to have a job, she wasn't allowed to do anything. She was completely contained to the house, and if she went out, it was timed. And, you know, and looking back in life, she probably didn't realize that we picked up on that. But until I was older and I could break it down, I didn't put it together. You know, you don't put one and two together. And then you think about it later in life, you think, okay, now I can see why those habits were formed.
Right.
Yeah.
I was going to ask you, who's an influential person in your world? But you kind of answered that in a way, because I think your mom, despite all her intricacies, let's say, politically correct, is she was a very, very strong woman. And I would love for you to share the story of how she essentially escaped with you both.
I remember it was after one particular event that was the one that we heard on the recording, that she just started saving money from the, because she was never given money outside of the money that she was given to do the shopping, the grocery shopping, and pay the bills. And that's how you're poor. And she just kept a little bit of money back every week until she had enough money to put us on a train and come to Perth from Victoria. And I remember seeing my brother and I down and saying she has to leave because the violence is getting so bad that he's going to end up killing her. And that was a fact, you know, that she'd had broken ribs and black eyes and you name it, it had been done to her. And we both said, we're coming with you. We're out of here, kind of thing. So, and I still remember that particular morning when we just, she had bags, so she put things into the drawers in a way she could pack them within minutes into bags, and we were out the door into a taxi to the train station, and we headed to Perth. Yeah, never looked back. Never looked back. Strong woman. Strong, strong woman, because she came here from a life that was obviously very difficult to nothing, a few thousand dollars in her purse, and straight to government housing, where we went into State Housing Commission flats and lived there until, you know, we were much older.
And some of the stories that you've told me is that these premises were not terribly safe, nor were they hygienic. Cockroaches, rats.
Yeah, well, I do remember we lived on Barron Way in some flats, and mum is a bit like me, you know, everything in a straight line, everything clean and immaculate. But, you know, we lived in a huge set of flats, something like you'd probably recognise in Queens, you know, but an Australian version. And the people were for all sorts of walks of life, and it wouldn't be the way I'd like my kids to be brought up. But kudos to my mum, you know, my brother has turned out great. I've done okay in life, and you know, she was one of those mums that took whatever the environment was around her and talked to us. She was a fantastic mother.
Wow, amazing lady.
Yeah,
looks like you're getting a bit emotional. What makes you emotional when you think of your mum?
I just think she did it so tough. Yeah. You know, she was a mum and a dad. Just a strong woman. Very strong woman.
Well, cheers to your mum.
Yeah, for all of the faults that I've probably picked up. She was a fantastic mum, provided for us, you know, gave us every resource in life we could possibly need to make the right decisions for ourselves. And, you know.
I truly believe that. I think the characteristics that your mum displayed and displays currently, I think are your actual biggest strengths. And my passion is to see the remarkable nature of everyone. And I truly believe that's one of your strengths. Your ability to become remarkable is, although you are this tough superhero on the outside, on the inside, I think you have such empathy. And I think slowly but surely, I'm turning you into an even more bigger, mushier ball of mush, which is, I think, evident right now.
Yeah. You know, and it's also, my brother and I went to a tough school. You know, you didn't have a sandwich at lunchtime, you had a fight. Mm. And I wasn't the tough kid at school, my brother was. So no one messed with my brother. So, you know, no one messed with me until my brother wasn't at the school. And then, let me tell you, within the throw of a dime, when he left school, I was a target. So I had to toughen up pretty quickly. And I think, you know, you look back and, you know, I still have interaction even today on Facebook with some of the school groups and things. And it all shapes you. You know, when you think about even my two daughters, I think the fact that their mum and I don't fight is shaping them better because they're not having to deal with all of that toxicity. And you know, it's trying to shape things the best you can with the relationships that surround you, and then making sure the relationships that surround you are the ones that make you better and help you grow. And my mum's one. She's an integral part of why I am the way I am, because she's hard as nails. At the end of the day, she has been a fabulous mum. But when I think back, you know, I remember days that she didn't eat because there wasn't enough food. And it's like, she said she wasn't hungry. It was a hot day. She came home, she made dinner. But what it really was is there was not enough food. So she made sure my brother and I ate and she didn't. And again, it's one of those things you look back in life and you go, oh, shit, there wasn't enough food in the house. And it all makes you grow, you know. So that's why, like I'm with your family, to me, and sometimes it's my undoing, my generosity, you know, making sure that my family has things that we would never have had otherwise, you know, and that you just help them in the ways you can, mentally, financially. And you know, my brother and I probably weren't even really great friends until he was in his late 20s and had kids, and I didn't have kids, so he used to treat his sons like they were mine. And give them everything. Yeah, it got me in trouble a lot because the first time I bought them motorbikes, I remember the drama with my sister-in-law that, you know, but then now they're motorcycle crazy guys. They've got multiple motorbikes. They've grown up. And they're great guys. They're good, solid guys. And I remember thinking, man, if I can have kids and they can have that sort of manners and do and just those attributes, I'd be so happy. And I've got two daughters now that I'm super proud of that are just good kids.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
It's funny because they're quite chalk and cheese, like you and I, in so many ways. You know, the younger one, Tiffany, has, let's just say, chutzpah, I think is the other one. And the older one has such a gentle nature. And it's funny to see their attributes because as a female without children, it's been really interesting. I guess I take the research approach and sort of observe it. And it's been really interesting to see how they've been affected by your incredible nature. Now, the one thing I'll say is that oftentimes, well, I should say from a personal perspective, when I listen to these stories, it kind of reminds me of when we were first dating. You would go off on these tangents about stories about this, that, and the other. And I just thought, what a wanker, making up all these stories to impress me. And like this guy is just clearly has something to prove. Now, to preface this in saying that on our first birthday, as in your birthday that we spent together, we got together a whole bunch of your friends, and I asked them each to tell a funny story about their time with you. And lo and behold, each and every one validated every friggin' story that you said. So the reason why I'm saying this is to the audience, oftentimes you listen to people and you think, did that actually really happen? Or did that actually really happen in that way? But it did. And I would love to, not end particularly, but I would like to sort of start to summate by you telling us a story about you going to, now I can't remember where it was, but I remember that you were taken off a plane with armed guards. You're laughing.
Sorry. Yeah. So that was Yemen. I was putting together an oil deal, and I had the head of Power Soraya out of Singapore with me. I had a colleague of mine here out of Perth who was the CEO of an oil and gas company that was looking for a new project, And through my connections through Asia, I was introduced to the son of a very, very high up diplomat in Yemen. And basically, we were told, come to Yemen and you can have the pick of the bunch. Like, have a look at the available tenements and, guys, just select one and we will make sure you get it, because it's all about who you know in those countries. But the thing I never forget is the first time we went, we landed and the plane stopped short of the terminal, and these cars pulled up alongside the plane, and they had one of those utilities with a staircase attached to it, and these armed guards came onto the plane, and we're thinking, oh shit, something's going down. The next thing you know, we have this British voice ask for Mr. Bosanac and my colleagues, and I remember my colleague shit himself because he's thinking we're dead. And the other guys that had been there before thought it was pretty normal and they were pretty relaxed. So anyway, this chap who's obviously ex-SAS or the British equivalent, we identified ourselves. He says, oh, guys, you're coming with us. And, you're sucking air through your asshole. It's one of those things you've got no idea what's about to happen. You're in a foreign country, a dangerous one at that. It was not long after September 11, and we are in Yemen, right? So anyway, so we got off the plane and the guy asked for our passports. So we reluctantly, but really very little choice, they've got guns up the wazoo, give them to this guy, and they put us in these Mercedes and they drive us off the tarmac and to this other area where diplomats are taken through customs, and they got our bags and they checked us through really quickly. But the funny part was, outside of that, and that, a little bit of pee came out, was that we went out to the cars and the guy gives us bulletproof vests. And at that point I started getting worried. But then he gave us two sidearms. So, basically gun holders, to strapped us with these gun holders and two handguns, and said, you know how to shoot a gun. And I'd been brought up with guns. Dad taught us how to shoot guns. And I'll never forget the other chap going, why do we need these, in a really shaky voice, because he was absolutely crapping himself. And he said, that's if they get through me. And it's like the guy, and I laughed at that point because I thought, this is not real. The danger was real. Let's not. We're in Yemen, so there's zero question about the danger. But if they get through me, he'd rehearsed that. But it was fabulous. Anyway, get in these cars and off we go. They put my guys in one car, me another car, and there's three Mercedes. But I'm in the front one, and there's a utility in front of us with four guys on the front, and there's another one at the back of the entourage of cars. Four guys in the back, and they've got every sort of weapon strapped to them that they could without being able to not walk. And I never forget, I got my phone out, and I think I've shown you these photos, and I started taking photos through the windscreen of this guy with everything from night goggles to big machine guns, the whole nine yards. And he took his goggles up and he looked at me, and I don't know if you know much about Yemenis, but they've got these eyes from being in the desert that could cut through glass. And he looked at me, and all he did was shake his finger back and forward to say no photos. And I put my camera down straight away because it was like, this guy wasn't joking. And then we got to the hotel and we're staying at the Movenpick. And of all places that hotel is located, it's right next to the US Embassy. So you pull into this gate and it's only one route for one car at a time. And they close these monstrous iron gates back and front. And then they come and they look under the car for bombs and all the rest of it, because you are next to the American embassy. So they want to make sure that there aren't any weapons or bombs. And we're cleared, obviously. And as we go down the driveway, the driveway used to be a big loop, but you can see they put these massive concrete bollards. So you had to zigzag down the driveway. And all the way down the driveway, there's a 50 cal machine gun locked on you from the front door of the hotel. And I've never experienced this because I've never been to any of these places. So just the intensity of going through that, it was quite a life experience. I remember telling you this story and you didn't believe it until you heard it again. But it's one of those things in life you think, wow, what is going on in the world? And then we got to the hotel and it was everything through a metal detector. We got wandered down the whole nine yards, and it was just crazy, the amount of security to get to our hotel room. But it was that's one of my many stories that you didn't believe.
One of many, I should preface. And I think that is a truly remarkable story. And remarkable is something unusual or surprising or something worth noting. And I think that is a fantastic way to end this podcast. So I'd just like to thank you and your huge bottle of whiskey that has come and that has been trustworthy enough to allow me to dig deep and unpick all the uncomfortable parts of you. So everyone else, before I sign off, I just want to say thank you from the bottom of my heart for listening. There are thousands of podcasts out there, and you've chosen to listen to me, and that's truly a gift that I cherish. Last but not least, as a new podcast, your help would mean the absolute world to me and keep me motivated to keep on recording these episodes. So if you could spare a few seconds to subscribe to the podcast and share it with a friend, well, gosh golly, that would just absolutely mean the world to me and make my day. Until next time, never forget that every day is a new opportunity to do something truly remarkable. So why not make today your time to shine? Toodles for now.